Please get me some warm water, just some water. I'm prepping for a colonoscopy this morning, so we might have a five-minute tomorrow. We may have a five-minute colon break in the middle. We'll see how that goes. And the doctor, surprisingly, just some trivial information. If you're going to have a colonoscopy, don't have anything that's red, like cranberry juice, because they said that stains the intestine a little bit, so they can't, or the colon, so they can't see the polyps or whatever, if there are any. We have some cocktail party trivia now. Okay. So good evening.
Good evening.
Good to see you. We're going to begin with a little meditation, rather than saying words of prayers, although words are important. Sit comfortably. I see a few newer faces. Sit comfortably with your spine erect if you can, your eyes partially closed. Just relax both your body physically. I sometimes find it useful to tell myself, relax. And then relax your mind. Remind yourself any of the problems that we have now that might seem really irritating and compelling to think about. In a year, 2 years, 5 years, they'll be laughable. We know the things that have been so important to us early parts of our lives. We fell in love, or we lost a job, or we had some big problem. A couple of years later, it wasn't so compelling. So place your attention on the breathing, your mindfulness. In the sense of just watching it, not controlling it. Use that to tie the wild elephant of your mind to, so it doesn't go off to other thoughts. You might find it useful to imagine withdrawing your attention away from the eyes and ears and even your body inward toward your heart, like a turtle or tortoise withdrawing its head and four legs. Withdraw your five senses inward to just your mental consciousness, watching the breathing, being aware of the subtle breath. switch your awareness from watching the breathing to watching the mind itself. In particular, not the contents of your mind. And here, when I say mind, I don't mean your eye consciousness or ear consciousness or even your body consciousness, but your mental consciousness. Don't watch the content so much as try to be aware of the spaciousness of the mind that allows the contents to be there. The clear light nature of the mind. Tie the elephant of your mind to that with the rope of mindfulness. If you notice thoughts arising, nip them in the bud. As soon as you notice thoughts arising, visual or auditory, emotional, let go of them immediately and try to sense the nature of the mind within which they're arising. Again, go back to the clarity. In a sense, you're using those thoughts as aids to recognize the clarity, because without the mind being clear, the thoughts could not arise, they couldn't change, they couldn't enter or leave. Try to recognize my mind is like a vast space, unimpeding, like a vast ocean. Within this mind, I can develop all of the good qualities that I long for. Peace of mind, contentment, joy, friendliness, compassion, wisdom. Patience. I can eliminate all the faults, anger and unquenchable lust and desire, laziness, jealousy, depression, low self-esteem. This evening, in this class, I'm going to dedicate this time, my energy now, to listening to the teachings so that I can transform. I can become a better friend, mother, father, brother, sister, son or daughter. In fact, beyond just the relationships of this lifetime, I'm going to listen, participate in the class tonight to learn the techniques to bring the spiritual teachings into my everyday life so that I can eventually become enlightened, can reach my highest potential without any ulterior motive. I can reach out to others, work for their welfare, alleviate their suffering, just as we love to be cared for, to care for others. We're going to participate to learn the methods to become a Buddha for the sake of others. bring your attention back to the present. Relax. How was your meditation? When I was thinking, when I said nip it in the bud, I was going to say, excuse me, Bucky. He's also called Bucky. But he might take offense or something. Let me ask you a question. Let's imagine a big boulder right here. Do that big boulder. Or where this black thing is. Big boulder. Where there is this boulder, is there space? You know, the boulder's solid. It's not a hollow boulder. It's not a trick question that way. It's not a styrofoam boulder. It's a real granite boulder. Where is that boulder is situated, is there space? There is space. Ed, right? No. Yeah. Why is there space there? You can't move anything in that area, right? If I tried to move my wristwatch into that space, it would be obstructed. And space is said to be the lack of obstruction.
At this level, there's obstruction.
There is obstruction, so there's no space.
No,
I'm not talking about the space between the atoms
okay.
or between the molecules or anything. I'm talking about just whether in general there's space there.
Space is defined by direction.
Whether there's obstruction or not. You'll see where I'm getting at. You might say, what was he talking about this one?
There's no space.
Oh, okay, good. I needed a fall guy. Okay, so someone to say something. So there is space. There. Why do we know there's space? Because if there was no space, the boulder would not be able to be there. The very fact that the boulder is there should lead us to have an intuition that there is space there. Otherwise, the boulder couldn't be in that position. Why do I say that? When we meditate on the nature of the mind, sometimes a thought is there, kind of concrete, boulder-like, my anger, my attachment, you know, whatever, depression, can't get rid of it. It's like it's immovable. Just recognizing that the very fact that that thought is there proves logically. We can logically infer that there is space in the mind. Otherwise, if the mind wasn't spacious, didn't have this clear light nature, that thought couldn't be present in the same way that the boulder couldn't be present unless there was space. Okay? So even when your mind is chaotic, going bananas, gaga, whatever you go, you can let go of that. If you have that kind of familiarity from this meditation of watching the nature of the mind, you can let go of those thoughts in an instant because their very presence infers this clear nature of the mind. And focus on it. As you focus on it and you don't give the thoughts their usual purchase, their usual traction, they can begin to, as you don't give them energy, they will begin to dissipate like a cloud in the sky, and your mind can reach some calm. I remember at a course in Italy, maybe Don was there, when Lama taught the six yogas in Naropa, were you there many years ago? And one of the monks at the time, an Italian fellow, Piero Cherry, Lama said, how is your meditation on the clarity of the mind? And Piero said, oh, Lama, I can't meditate, and my mind is so chaotic, thinking, you know, the planes flying through my mind. And Lama said, that's the best time. You know, to use a situation that's challenging, as we'll be talking about in the Lojong teachings, to use that challenging situation as grist for the mill, fodder for your fertilizer for your spiritual practice. even when that's there, just to let go, just that slight different stance, to look at the situation in a different way, rather than getting caught up in the thought, let go of that, and to see that it infers the clarity of the mind. There are other ways also, we'll talk about, in a minute we'll begin this text, but another thing that's useful, just a slight different stance looking at things makes quite a bit of difference. Saturday night, you haven't been invited to the cocktail party at the university or wherever, you haven't been invited to the barbecue. I guess that's big here. You haven't been invited to the barbecue, and you're home alone, and you think, you're depressed, you're lonely, nobody loves you, you're alone, focusing on that, you know. Others are there, you weren't invited. Just a slight different stance, thinking, I'm alone. Rather than, you know, the connotation of, you know, I'm alone, depressed, I'm bad. I have space to do the things I've wanted to do. You know, I can read these Dharma texts that I've been wanting to do. I can do this meditation that I've wanted to do. It's all in how you look at things, how you use the situation. My teacher Lama Yeshe once, when we were at Kopan Monastery, and I had bought a tape recorder, a dictating machine that I was using to not only record teachings but also to study Tibetan. And Lama Sopa Rinpoche, some of you know, the founder of the director of Kadampa Center, the spiritual advisor, so to speak, or director. Lama Sopa was coming out of his room and must have been meditating for many hours and he was rubbing his eyes and he saw the tape recorder and he said, "Oh, that's fantastic, tape recorder. Oh, this is wonderful. You know, Peter Kedge just bought a camera. What can you do with a camera? You know, this is fantastic." And Lama Yeshe looked at Lama Sopa, who was his student, and said, "Depends on what you do with it, Sopa." Lama wasn't being wrathful with Lama Sopa. He was leaving an imprint in my mind, you know. Depends on what you do with it, whether you have good things, whether you have wealth and spare time, you know, leisure. Depends on what you do with it. It's not necessarily good. And things that we find maybe as obstacles to the path, depends on what you do with them. As we'll learn now as we study this text, ways to transform adverse conditions into the path. You know, looking at it in a different way, using it for your benefit rather than it being an obstacle. So what we're going to study for a couple of classes, for four classes it looks like, is a text called The 7-Point Training of the Mind, Lojung Donduma. Very, very famous. There are three famous texts like this in the Tibetan tradition, especially popular because of their profundity and ease of understanding. There's one other text you might have studied sometime called The 8 Verses of Training the Mind. Has someone taught that recently around here? His Holiness often teaches because brief. You might say, well, this must be shorter because it's only 7 points. That's 8 verses. Well, that's 8 verses. These 7 points, they have a lot of other subsidiary things. It's actually a bit longer. And there's a longer mind training text called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons, Sunjo Korlo. That's longer than both of these. That's especially useful. That I believe His Holiness the Dalai Lama will teach in New York. Is that right? In September? Mm-hmm. So that if you have an opportunity to attend that, you'll know that's the same kind of genre of literature, Lojung. Lojung, lo here means awareness or mind. Jung means to train or purify. So this is a kind of literature that's talking about methods to put into everyday practice the Lanrim teachings, especially centering on the two essential things that we want to train our mind in, what's called the conventional altruistic mind, developing good heart, compassion, and the wish to achieve our highest potential for the sake of others. That particular mind we call conventional bodhicitta. That's one of the things that we try to find ways to train in everyday life. And the other is what is in the literature called the ultimate bodhicitta. You might think, well, that must be better than the conventional bodhicitta because it's the ultimate one. What it means is the wisdom in that understands ultimate reality, the wisdom of emptiness, as we had talked in our previous course, that is conjoined with this altruistic intention to help others. If you just have that wisdom of emptiness alone, it's not called ultimate bodhicitta. Just that wisdom. But in the mind stream of a bodhisattva, someone who has conventional bodhicitta, you know, a very noble being aiming to help others, then when they develop that wisdom of emptiness, that wisdom is called the ultimate bodhicitta because it's within their mind, their bodhi mind, their mind aiming for enlightenment or bodhi. It's an ultimate awareness of ultimate truth. This text I received teachings on several occasions and have studied and taught, but one particular occasion when I received it from a Tibetan Lama who died some years ago and has been reborn and is a monk again, his reincarnation is a monk again at Sarah College. His name is Gomo Tuku. And did you ever meet Gomo Tuku? He was with us in Italy at Istituto Lama Tsongkhapa for, many months before he passed away, maybe almost a year. He gave many, many teachings. And he gave a teaching on this. He said that Gomo Tuku in that life had been a monk, recognized as a reincarnate lama at an early age. He'd become a monk and studied at the monastery, became a master of the teachings. But then some obstacles arose in his life, became a layman, gave back his vows, and he lived, I believe, in Dalhousie with his wife and his family. Just as a side, his daughter of that life became his mother of the next life. That's interesting. When his reincarnation was found, it turned out to be his daughter's son. You know, after he had passed away, she had a baby.
So he was his own grandson.
You know that one? I am my own granddad or something. It's a great song. So Gomo Tuku told a story how at that point of his life, a layman again, and he began to feel that, you know, the Dharma had somehow deceived him. His life had gone to ruin. He began to blame his gurus for problems. There's even space up here if you want. Do you like to sit up here? Yeah?
This is their seats.
And the tickets for those seats are very inexpensive. Much less than the hockey game tonight. Gomo Tuku said that, he even recognized that he was blaming his guru for problems and blaming other people. And he went to see his root guru, Kabji Trijang Rinpoche, who was a tutor of the Dalai Lama. And Rinpoche said, reread this text, the 7-point training of the mind. Study it. This is the solution to your problem. And so Gomo Tuku did that and wrote a commentary. I think there is a text that the very commentary he gave to us at that time has been published by Wisdom Publications. It's, if you check on Borders or whatever, Wisdom, under Gomo, G-O-M-O, Gomo Tuku, you can find that commentary also. So Rinpoche said that in studying this and going back, and he wrote a commentary, this had eliminated all of that kind of problem from his mind, and he was able to use all of the occurrences of his life as in their proper perspective, see them in their proper perspective and use them for his practice. And then he came back and taught us for many months and now is recognized as a tulku at Sarah. Maybe Ty, you're going to go to Sarah sometime eventually, right? Yeah, maybe he'll be, I think he's in his early 20s, so maybe you'll debate with the reincarnation of Gomo Tuku sometime. So I have, this is a small copy, the same version but from Wisdom Publications, but a different earlier printing of one that you may have, if some of you have it. This is a text called Advice from a Spiritual Friend, which is a compendium of several teachings about Lojong. But in the second part of this, I'm not sure if it was in the same format there, there is this text called the Seven-Point Training of the Mind. Here it's called the Seven-Point Thought Transformation. So this is a commentary by Geshe Rapton, who was also one of my teachers, who was the guru of both Lama Yeshe and Lama Sopa Rinpoche, very great Lama, who escaped from Tibet along with Geshe Sopa, I understood. Geshe Sopa refers to him as Rapton. Rapton. So the beginning, the introduction here. Let me just mention, it would be very useful for those of you who are, you know, eager to take advantage of these kinds of teachings, to memorize what these 7 points are. There are a lot of different stanzas, maybe that some might want to memorize those too, but at least what the 7 points are. You know, if someone were to say, oh, I studied the 7-point training of the mind, and they would say, oh, what are those points? And you say, well, I don't know. might be a little bit cause for embarrassment. So, and I'm going to test you later. So the first point is the training in the preliminary practices. That's one of the points, to train in the preliminaries, and we'll talk about that. The second point is called the actual instruction. So remember what I said, the main gist of the 7-point training, or all the Lojong, is to train our mind into two bodhicittas, conventional mind of bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. So the actual instruction is the verses in the 7-point training of the mind that lead one into understanding how to develop ultimate bodhicitta and conventional bodhicitta. We'll try to cover some of those tonight. The third point is one of the most, for us, most relevant. It's called transforming adverse conditions into the path. Does that terminology make sense to you? Do you know what that means? Adverse conditions means the things that we might think of as hindering our practice. Say you're going to Kadampa Center to do Myungne in a couple of weeks or something, or to do some puja or make prostrations. And your neighbor stops to argue with you, and you start getting mad at them because this is adverse condition. This is a problem preventing me from practicing virtue. You should think this is my practice. This is giving me the opportunity, because I'm getting angry right now. This is actually an opportunity for me to practice. It's just an example. So the preliminaries, the actual instructions, transforming adverse conditions into the path. And then there is a section that is translated variously. We might say elucidating one life's practice, condensing the practices of one lifetime, sort of in essence, how to put all the practices of a lifetime in a few words. The fifth point is called the measure of having trained the mind, in the same way that you would take the measure of, say, an expert carpenter or mechanic would have a test they would give to someone to see whether they'd mastered the techniques. So this is a way to know whether we have the measure, the criterion of having trained the mind. The sixth point is called the commitments of training the mind. In Tibetan we say damsik, or Sanskrit they call samayas. Maybe some of you who've studied tantra and other things, you've heard that word before. The commitments, promises that we make in that regard. And the seventh point are the trainings of this mind transformation, or training of the mind. Okay? So those are called the seven topics that we're going to talk about. And if you have a text, you can follow along. First of all, before even the first point, there's a verse that says, Om Svasti. Svasti is an Indian word. You know the word swastika? Actually, swastika. It's this. Actually, that means auspicious. So at the beginning, it says, may things be auspicious. Homage to great compassion, or homage to great compassion, depending on how you like to pronounce. Usually at the beginning of texts, there is some homage that's paid by the author in order to create the merit to finish the composition. So this text, sort of the essence of all of our thrust in practicing the Mahayana, is to develop great compassion. Great compassion is a state of mind that empathizes with others. Who is it? Was Marty here today? Marty was saying, when I was talking to him this afternoon, talking about empathy. You know, he said, well, how do you develop compassion? And I was saying, you know, to empathize with others. And he said, I hate that. I'm a guy. Empathy sounds like something, it's a kind of a girl thing. And we bantered that around a bit. Actually, we all have male and female energy within us. Whether you think of empathy as being a gal thing, I don't know. I don't think it's more related with woman than man. But it shouldn't be a problem, because the aim of our practice is to try to develop our male and female energies. To like the in the symbology of Tantra, the embracing of the male and female, yeah, deities. Not necessarily sort of mystic, but, you know, with great bliss. So homage to great compassion. The essence of this nectar of advice is in a continuity from Serlingpa. This is a preface to the text. So this is telling the source of the text. Do you know who Serlingpa was? Serlingpa is Suvarnadipa. Suvarna means gold. Serlingpa means the golden island, the individual from the golden island. He was the guru of Atisha, the great Indian saint, who traveled some 13 months by ship and great difficulty to study from this particular individual who held the teachings on the Prajnaparamita practices, both the wisdom and especially the development of good heart in bodhicitta. Atisha received these kinds of instructions from, the Tibetans call him Serlingpa. In Sanskrit they say Suvarnadipa. I don't know, that's the golden island. I think that that means Indonesia or Java in general, but he was called, that was his personal name, his family name, this guru. So the essence of this, of these teachings, the essence of this nectar of advice is in a continuity from Serlingpa. So Serlingpa passed on this kind of teaching, training of the mind, developing bodhicitta, to Atisha, who then passed it on to his disciples when he came to Tibet. Those disciples were called, interestingly enough, Kadampas. Do you know why I'm saying that? This center is called the Kadampa Center. Do you know what that means, Kadampa?
One who puts all the teachings of the Buddha into practice.
You could say that. One who is, it refers to, in Tibetan, when we say Kangyur, that means the speech or proclamation, the teachings. It's an honorific word for the speech of the Buddha. And Dampa means instruction. So one who takes the speech of the Guru and the Buddha as instruction to put into practice. This was a special quality of Atisha's disciples. This is how he taught them to be. You know, just don't become an academic with the teachings. Don't just, you know, be able to quote and say, I know the 7 points, George talked about. Put them into practice. You know, take them as instruction for personal instruction, to be bound by those. Let me tell you one other anecdote at this point. When I was leaving Copan in probably 78 or 79 to go to England to take on a post there, I asked my teacher, Lama Yeshe, I bowed down, made three prostrations, and asked him if he had any advice before I left, because we were about to begin a very intensive study of the scriptures, what they call the Geshe program. And Lama thought for a minute, and he said, intellectual Mount Meru. Do you know what Mount Meru is? When we talk about Abhidharma, all these teachings, sort of the center of the universe, all these details, levels, and everything. Lama said, intellectual Mount Meru isn't worth kaka. That was his advice. Kaka, you know, right? Universal talk. Universal, all languages for excrement. Intellectual knowledge itself, it can be a big impediment, can cause you to puff up with pride, not to realize that you're not practicing. Intellectual knowledge itself is not worthy of equating even with excrement. But if you use that knowledge in the right way, it can fertilize your practice. So don't become a mere scholar. Try to put the teachings into practice. So those are the preliminary verses. And then the first topic of the seven points, the first point is train in the preliminaries. Here it says train in all the preliminaries, but it doesn't say all, it's just a plural, just plural, train in the preliminaries. So what does that mean? If we want to develop these two special minds and find a way of utilizing it in everyday life, we have to first get familiar with and train in those teachings that the Buddha gave subsidiary to these sublime teachings of conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. We have to train in the preliminaries. Here it doesn't mean preliminaries of sometimes people say, I'm doing the preliminary practices, I'm making 100,000 mandala offerings or 100,000 prostrations. It's not talking about those preliminaries. It's talking about the teachings that are found in the stages of the path, what's called the Lanrim, that are preliminary to developing bodhicitta. So these are the teachings on recognizing the spiritual guide, finding a spiritual guide, cultivating a relationship with them, finding the right way to relate with them and to devote oneself to them, because that's the root of all of our achievement. The meditation on recognizing something that we have right now that we may not recognize, which is a life of leisure and endowment. You might say, well, George, Ben White, he has a life of leisure and endowment, but not me. I got to work. I'm not retired. Well, I don't mean that kind of leisure, the leisure to be able to read books and do things at your own pace and so forth. But here, a life of leisure and endowment means a life in which we're not oppressed by the suffering and ignorance that comes in most of lives that we encounter. Say, if we were an animal, you might think it's better than a lot of human beings, a lot of human lives, and maybe some animals are better than most humans, some humans. But if we were an animal right now, sitting here, I would wager there's not an animal alive that would be taking notes as some of you are, or would be able to quote back later what the seven points are, or would be able to practice in any way. That's an unfree state, a state of lacking of leisure. Here the leisure that's talked about is the leisure to practice Dharma, the freedom to practice the Dharma. If we're born as a spirit, or as Buddhism believes it's possible to be born in hell, no way that we could practice the Dharma.
I have a question. Does that apply to all human beings, or are there some human beings on earth, not in hell, but on earth that don't have that leisure?
Yeah. What did George Orwell say? All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Something like that. Yeah, when we're talking about a life of leisure and endowment, it's not simply to be what we have to recognize. We won't go through all the details, but those of you who have received teachings or are interested can investigate in the Lanrim teachings. what constitutes a life of leisure? It means, first of all, not to be born in these unfree states. And that also includes some human states. For instance, a state that's unfree would be born in a totalitarian country, which remains totalitarian for all your life, so you have no freedom to practice religion. What we might call a barbarian land. In previous times, it might be born in a place where the customs are barbaric. There is no sense of spiritual teachings. Either you're physically devoid, a long distance from spiritual teachings, and the people have these barbaric customs, or the regime is aware of spirituality, like communist China, in previous decades, and it chose to make it prohibited in a very strong way. You could also be born as a human with lacking all of the faculties. That means, in one sense, it talks about in the scriptures being blind and deaf, although you can point to exceptional people like Helen Keller, who was able to become an exceptional person. Generally, being born blind and deaf, especially in earlier times, was a great impediment to receiving the teachings. You couldn't read them, you couldn't hear them. But it especially means the faculties, to be deficient in the faculties of wisdom and mindfulness and concentration, these faculties. That would be an unfree state. You don't really have the ability to practice the teachings. Also, if you're an incredibly opinionated, which is what generally we say, holding wrong views, what it means, the way that we would say it today is to be incredibly opinionated in a sense that precludes you from practicing, entering into the practice. There's Buddhist karma, shmarma, there's no such thing, holding a very strong opinion that there's no future lives, there's no past lives, there's no such thing as enlightenment. Holding opinions like that, because of imprints from past lives, would put one in a situation where you really didn't have the freedom to practice. And also, even born as a human when the teachings don't exist in the world, in dark ages, when the Buddha, the way that it's phrased in the teachings, very, very tasty, not being pleased with Buddha's descent. So it could be, you could take it different ways. Not Buddha's descended and you're not pleased about it, or not having, how do we use it in English? Not being pleased with Buddha's descent also means not having the good fortune to be present when the Buddha had descended to earth, taught the Dharma, and the teachings are active. So that's a life of leisure, being free of those unfree states, and being endowed with various qualities. It doesn't mean being born to a rich family, but being born as a human in a religious country with your faculties intact, wisdom and your other faculties. Not having created heavy negative actions that would prevent a continuity of human rebirths in the future, what they call the actions of immediate retribution, having killed, drawn blood from the Buddha, or killed your mom and dad. There were some people in Los Angeles a couple of years ago who killed their mom and dad, wasn't it? There's some brothers, the Menendez brothers.
There was one in Chapel Hill last year.
Really? So for Buddhists, from the Theravada teachings, the Hinayana teachings, it said those actions are, they don't talk about them being purified, but if they're not purified immediately after this lifetime, they're of such enormity that they will cause one to be born immediately in unfree states in hell. So, to have faith from our side, to have faith in these teachings, to have some kind, or at least some hope, in what are called the three baskets of Buddhist teachings. This is one of the opportune things that we have, an endowment that we have, that not everyone has in the world today. From the outside, the Buddha has arisen, turned the wheel of Dharma, taught, and those teachings still exist. there's a community of aspirants like ourselves who can, we say the Sangha, who we can join or we can use as inspiration in laity to take the medicine of the Dharma. And then there are benefactors, laity generally, but sometimes monastic, who provide the cooperative conditions to practice. These are called the 10 endowments. We just went over them briefly. If you're interested, you can check in the Lanrim teachings. So this is another preliminary to get familiar with. The reason for doing so is to recognize what we have, not knowing what we have, that's so valuable, to recognize what you could be doing with this lifetime. With this lifetime, of course, you could become the next Bill Gates. You could become maybe the first trillionaire. There's no one, at least right now, there's no trillionaire, right? They're getting up to the hundreds of billions and like this. You could become the most famous person in the world. You could become the most beautiful. You could have washboard abs. You could win the Olympics, endow a chair at Chapel Hill. Lots of things you could do. You could have lots of friends and family and children and be content. But all of those things, none of those things can be taken with you. There's an adage in Buddhism that at the time of death, the beggar and the king die the same way. The king can't take one coin from his treasury or one of his concubines. The beggar can't take his begging bowl or staff. They leave equally. So in that perspective, recognizing what you can do with this life to provide the sustenance for future happiness of future lives, and in so doing find deep contentment now. It's not as though if you enter into a spiritual path you forget about the happiness of this, you know, you don't have any happiness in this lifetime. You're like those people in that we might have worried that we might become some kind of ivory tower, sort of pasty complexion, never having any fun, you know. Not like that. If you ever heard the lamas laugh, Lama Sopa Rinpoche, if you've ever heard them laugh, that's or the Dalai Lama, that's a happy guy. You know? It's said that in Tibet, one of their main crops was barley, that everyone, they would roast the barley, and they would grind it, and they would make a cereal they called sampa. Have you heard of that? Mm-hmm. Sampa. And it was their staple. They said that when you planted the barley crop, the intention was to get the fruit, the seed, the barley grain. That was your aim in planting the crop. But by the way, you also got the straw, you know, the shaft upon which the grain was, and the other parts of that. And after you harvested that and you took out the grain, and you had the grain, by the way, you had the straw to feed the yaks, to fill the mattresses, you know, to make other things. They say like that, the spiritual practitioner who takes as their aim ultimate, you know, long-term goals of happiness of future lifetimes, nirvana and enlightenment, who takes these goals as the thrust of their life, by the way, they can't but find happiness. You know, like that, like the straw comes along the way. There's no need to look for it, especially. You'll find love. You'll find success. You'll find resources. You'll find happiness. So recognizing what we have the ability now to develop compassion and concern for others, to find inner satisfaction. That's what we can do with this lifetime. It's said the sensation of recognizing that. Before we just thought, oh, you know, poor me, you know, we have a low self-esteem. We might have some ambitions for this lifetime, but we don't recognize that what we have is in a dynamic way. When you do recognize the value of leisure and endowment, what you can do with this lifetime, it's like a beggar having gone through the trash and finding a diamond. Yeah. Recognizing we've had this. Or as Nargarjuna said, to recognize that our life is like what was used in the corner before as a place to put the trash, to recognize that that's a jewel-encrusted vase. You've had all the time, but you never recognized it before. To recognize what we have right now. This is one of the preliminaries. Another preliminary is to contemplate that although we have this opportunity, it's changing. Our life is impermanent. We will definitely die. That's not meant to be a downer, you know, to bum you out. What that's meant to do is to encourage you to make use of this life while you have it, because it's momentarily, it's changing, it's eroding with every second. One of the meditation courses I attended at Kopan, I remember during the break time, people went out, Lama Zopa, some people were standing there asking questions. Lama Zopa was looking at a clock, a little clock on his table. You know how sometimes they click every second? Some of them, the second hand has such a fine gear, it actually just is moving, right? This one didn't have a second hand, but the minute hand actually had a very fine gear, and it wasn't just clicking by minute, it was moving. So he did a couple of double takes, and he said, it's changing even as I look at it. This is what our life is like. Right now, it's not as though we're not getting closer to death. Every second, it's as though we're falling through time. We are definitely going to die. Let me check. Anyone here thinks they're not going to die? We all think we're going to die. We would accept that, but we don't recognize that. We don't have a realization of that. We're not cognizant of that fact. If we were cognizant of that we're going to die, many of the problems of our lifetime would become insignificant. What do I mean by that? Say, for instance, someone comes in, Robbie goes out to the, gets a phone call, goes out, comes back and says, George, the United States military has sent a guided missile on a test, atomic weapon. It's accidentally headed toward Cary. It's going to arrive in 5 minutes. We can't even get away. We're doomed. At that point, if I say, Robbie, what about that $5 you owe me? He doesn't owe me $5. Right? Or we would say, you know, I'm still annoyed with you for doing this. We would, you know, in perspective of this imminent death, all of these other things would pale in comparison, right? If we had a real experience of the imminence of death. So the practitioner meditates in this way to try to get that feeling. We're moving toward death. We don't know when it's going to come. There may be someone in this room right now who's breathing and feels healthy who we won't see next year. Do you think so? Mm-hmm. Possible. You don't think so? You think everyone will be here next year?
I hope not.
You hope not. Right. But I'm not trying to jinx you. 6606 was yesterday. it had nothing to do with omens or anything. Don't worry. So we meditate. This is another preliminary. It's not meant only for some people. It's meant for all practitioners to go back over these essential teachings. These are the teachings that the lamas say. Well, Lama Yeshe used to say, meditating on death and impermanence is like an atomic weapon to blow up your problems. In the face of, you know, all of these things that we're worried about, definitely we're going to have to leave them anyway. They're changing every moment. The things that we find so compelling and attractive are changing. Just to look at them as, you know, with a mind of impermanence, seeing how they're going to be a year from now, 5 years from now, all of the, you know, say Timmy's taut body, you know, nice, what's the word, toned, fat, we say fat, P-H-A-T, not F-A-T.
That was middle school.
That was middle school. You know, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 50 years from now, beginning to sag, you know, the muscles, you know, wrinkles, teeth falling out, don't worry. I'm not criticizing. We're all that way. One very useful meditation that one teacher I received teachings from, a great Theravada master, Achan Cha, he said, take a flower from your garden, beautiful, fresh, just blooming, you know, glowing, cut it, bring it inside, put it in your kitchen, in a bowl of sand, and watch it, hour by hour, every time you go to the kitchen, have a cup of tea, take a look at that over the course of a couple of days. You'll see that change very, very quickly, kind of accelerate. That's kind of like meditation on impermanence. Look at yourself, look at others, the things that you're intrigued with. Definitely they're going to change. They won't be as appealing later. Definitely you have to leave them. You have to leave this life of leisure and endowment. This can give us energy to practice. That's another preliminary. So meditating on how to relate to the guru, meditating on the life of leisure and endowment, meditating on death and impermanence, and then meditating on what comes after that. The Buddha said, we do not cease at the time of death. Our mind stream, a subtle mind stream, continues and takes rebirth within six realms of cyclic existence. Some of them, the Buddha called high status, life as humans or gods. But most of the time, we're born in the lower realms as a hell being, a denizen of hell, or as a spirit, or as an animal. And we have no freedom to practice, and we suffer greatly. It's like one of these, I don't know, there's some kind of office toy, pendulum kind of thing. Most of the time, these things are bouncing, balls are bouncing. Most of the time it's down here. Once in a while, it kicks it in a certain way, it goes up, and immediately, most of the time is down here. I think that's a very good example for our lives in cyclic existence. We do circle, but most of the time we're in the lower realms. Once in a while we come up, but we don't take advantage of it. We may not have access to teachings. We may be opinionated. We may be born in a barbarian land. The Buddha may not have descended into the world. It might be a dark age. We might not be inclined to practice, even if everything is there. So recognizing that after this lifetime, due to the karma that we've created, even this lifetime, if you're really honest with yourself, the actions that we've created, probably we've created more causes to be born in the lower realms than to be born as a human. This meditation, we meditate on the suffering of the lower realms, the hell realms, animals, and so forth. Maybe some people might think, especially at meditation courses, I taught the one-month course at Kopan last November, that's usually the least appreciated part of the course, meditation on the suffering of hell, animal, and so forth. It's, you know, people are like, come on, and everyone's edgy at that time. They sent me many, many notes, unsigned notes, how I was so dogmatic and doctrinaire and so forth and so on. But this is one of the most important meditations. Later, to develop compassion, we have to understand the severity of suffering that exists. Otherwise, if you just see, you know, people on the beach, you have to really stretch your mind to see how they're suffering. You have to recognize that the majority of living beings in cyclic existence are in experiencing incredible torment right now, and that we ourselves can experience that. To put yourself in that situation and see what it's like. I had a kitty cat when I lived in Vermont many years ago, and in the Vermont winter, it got very, very cold. What I used to do is we had a lot of hot water. I'd turn on the hot water in the bathroom and let the bathtub fill with scalding hot water and close the door and let the room fill up with steam until the temperature of the water got bearable that I'd get in. So the room was already warmed up. Once the door had a little crack and the kitty cat, it was just a kitten, had gotten in there. And while I was in the other room waiting for the water to cool down, I heard the cat screaming. It had jumped up on the side of the tub, fallen in, and somehow was able to get out. and it was walking. The pads on the bottom of its feet had fallen off, you know, the little pads on each individual kind of toe or digit. And eventually it got prematurely gray, had a gray streak just in a couple of days on its head. It hid under the sofa for weeks. I recognize that kind of, when I think of that suffering, I can associate with it, you know, imagine what that suffering was like. That's the way to meditate on the suffering of the hell realm. You know, what is it like to be immersed in a boiling cauldron of liquid? You've created the karma in our lives to experience that. Even having what appear to be karmic, you know, guards push you back down with big sticks. You know, you come up for a breath and they push you back down again. Imagine what it was like when you were a kid and you almost drowned, you know. Use your life experiences of terror and fear and things that you have seen. Put that into those meditations. One of the current scholars of Buddhism, who also is a practitioner, John McCransky. He's a professor. He's Jewish. He's teaching Buddhism at Boston College. He loves to say this is quite interesting. John had the first Buddhist course was a course I gave at Copan, and during the meditation on the suffering of the lower realms, after that meditation he came. He had been crying during the meditation, and he said, "Now I know these states exist." You know, just through his experience. This is a guy who graduated from Princeton. It's not like some dumb, you know, dummy. Now I know these exist. He is though some intuition. We've experienced this numberless times in the past. We're going to experience it again unless we find some refuge from this. So the meditation on the suffering of the lower realms is meant to lead, to give up one of the essential causes of the next preliminary practice is called refuge. Refuge, you know, in a sense, if it's raining, we seek refuge under the bus shelter, right, or under the rain shelter, under the tree or something. I took a run the other day when it was pouring down, and once in a while I'd seek refuge under a tree where it was, the rain wasn't pouring down. Seeking refuge here from a Buddhist perspective is the defining characteristic of a Buddha, of a Buddhist, someone who takes refuge from the depth of their heart. It doesn't depend, some of you are maybe Buddhist, are your families Buddhist in Asia? You're from Thailand perhaps? Or
yes,
yeah,
from the Philippines.
Philippines, were you Buddhist there?
So,
okay. From a Buddhist perspective, though, merely being born to a Buddhist family doesn't make you Buddhist. Although some people, I like to joke to my students in Singapore, whether they have it on their identity cards as Buddhist, that doesn't cut the mustard. It doesn't make you Buddhist. Not like Judaism, where if your mom is Buddhist, if your mom is Jewish, you're a Jew, right? Buddhism doesn't take that kind of criterion to be a Buddhist. The criterion of being Buddhist is someone who takes refuge from the depth of their heart, sincerely, in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What does that mean to take refuge? One of the criterion of whether you're taking refuge is that you're worried. You have fear of suffering of the lower realms. Even you're in a higher sense. I don't know how to help others. I can't even cope with my own mind now. This kind of consternation or fear, especially the fear of the suffering of future lives, how could I protect against that? I have no means. And developing some confidence, at least hope, that the Buddha, the Dharma that he taught, and the Sangha that practices it can help us to protect us from that suffering. Having that confidence, initially just hope, you know, I hope they can help. Oh, you know, at the beginning, how can you have confidence? You can't have, you know, to have faith. That's the aim. But at the beginning, we don't have faith. It's like, you know, someone says, try this. This, you know, this is a nice sauna bath. And you take, you don't dive in immediately. Someone might dive in, but you took your toe in, you kind of taste it a bit. You hope that it's going to be okay. The same way in developing refuge. At first, we have some hope, we develop some confidence, and then we have some faith stronger faith based on our practice, day by day, week by week, year by year. This is working. The Buddha, you know, this is true. This kind of state, the main thing that protects us from suffering of the lower realms, that protects us from suffering now, unhappiness and so forth, the real refuge is the Dharma of those three. The Buddha is the external teacher of refuge, teacher of the Dharma, and what we aspire to be. That's the perfect, when we become Buddha ourselves, we will be totally free of all problems and suffering. The Dharma is the actual refuge, the teachings that you actualize, even if it's understanding impermanence. Just remembering, this will pass, that protects you from suffering. That's like the Dharma jewel. Whatever level of understanding you have of the Dharma, to value that in your own mind, to think of it as leading you to the actual Dharma jewel that will ultimately protect you from suffering. Famous logicians of Buddhism, Dharmakirti and Dignaga, they gave an example like this. If a jewel of the crown has fallen off and is down in the ground somewhere in the dust, you're looking for it. You can maybe nowadays we would say you're trying to find that sliver of glass that Timmy broke the bottle and there's glass on the floor. You're trying to find the last sliver. Even by the light reflecting off of that, or a facet of the jewel or a facet of the glass, and you say, oh, I see it. Actually, you don't see the jewel. You just see a facet of that, right? But by following that can lead you to the jewel or lead you to the piece of glass. In the same way, right now, what we perceive is not the actual Dharma jewel. It's just a little facet of it, impermanence, or, you know, practicing patience, practicing friendliness and kindness and love. We start to profit from that. Our life changes. By following that can lead us to the actual Dharma jewel, realization of emptiness, development of this kind heart. So this is another preliminary one practices, taking of refuge. Another preliminary is to train in karma. Train in karma almost sounds like training in lacrosse or something, right? Training in karma. This means in recognizing, once you've taken refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, particularly Dharma, what do you have to do? What is going to protect you from suffering? By abstaining from negative actions, because negative actions or karma, negative karma, have repercussions. You will reap what you sow. That's something that Christians also believe very strongly. If you want to experience happiness, you have to create the cause of happiness. If you want to be loved, you have to love others. If you want to be wealthy, you have to give. So starting to practice, to understand the intricacies of karma is another preliminary. That's something that some of you have studied with Geshe-la. You can study with Venerable as time goes on. If you haven't yet, review your study as a prelude to these teachings on training of the mind. Further, as a prelude to developing this special mind of bodhicitta, is a very special mind that we have to train in that we would call renunciation. Maybe that word in English doesn't have exactly, maybe it has a different connotation to you. It's not like, you know, if you renounce the world, it's the same as like saying, Dad, I renounce I'm no longer a member of this family. I renounce the family, you know. Or, you know, I renounce my American citizenship. Something like that. That's not the meaning of renunciation, renouncing. What the meaning is twofold. Viewing not just the gross suffering of future lives is problematic, anywhere within cyclic existence, even if we were to be born as a human again and have the best resources, we ourselves would be healthy, attractive, wealthy, influential. That would pass also. That's impermanent. And even the experience of those what the Lama sometimes called samsaric perfections. Even the experience of those doesn't satisfy. It's uncertain whether things will change. And even the experience of the example I gave before of stracciatella. Some of you know my favorite, my secret passion. Do you know what stracciatella is? It's kind of Italian ice cream, gelato. Not chocolate chips, but slivers of dark chocolate. Like, you know those things you cut the cheese with? You slice off cheese, so it's slivers of chocolate.
Shavings
mixed in. Oh, my fantasy is a huge refrigerated swimming pool filled with stracciatella, all mine. Big gates, some Doberman pinchers outside to keep Robbie and Don at bay. Linda, you can come in. You can come in.
Where can we get that?
Where is it? The gelato? So we had some.
Italiano in
Millsboro. Not the best, but it's approaching. So, but even if you were to have your dream, you know, my stash of stracciatella, or your stash of, you know, whatever your stash is, love, narcotics, wealth, condominium, you know, your stash of love, friends, all of those things, coming in contact with them only bring relief. They don't bring real happiness. The more you have them, you don't become happier and happier. Otherwise, the wealthiest people in the world would be incredibly happy. Oftentimes, it's the most wealthy people who are the most unhappy. Not necessarily, but it is often the case. If just having your stash... Can I use that word? That's from my old hippie days. Right? That's what when you had your some little bag of some weed or something. That's what you call it. Nowadays, there's all kinds of stash. It can be your 401k or your condominium or your you know DVDs or whatever. Your stash, your potato chips, whatever. Think about this. Within cyclic existence, any kind of pleasure that we find within cyclic existence that's come about from the articles that we encounter or relationships that we encounter that have come about because of karma and delusion, even though it's pleasurable, it's not real happiness. The most it can do is relieve some misery, exchanging it with some other misery. You have this idea that being in contact with stracciatella ice cream or you know your loved one or this reputation is going to make you happy. If you were tied down to a chair and someone comes up to you and says, "You're great. You know, I like you. You're really wonderful. I love you." First, you're like, "Oh, okay. Oh, that's nice. I've been wanting it. I haven't heard that in a long time." Some great pleasure would arise in your mind. Other people come again and again. A couple hours later, they're still coming. Someone else comes and you don't care any longer. You know, okay, you're tired. You have to hear this. There's no real pleasure in those words. If there were pleasure in those words, you should become more and more blissed out as time goes on. You sit in the sun and you say, after a time you start to sweat, you say, "Ty, let's go sit in a nice cool shade." So you go in the shade, the suffering of heat goes down, the suffering of cool goes up. At first, you say, "Ah, this is so nice, we're in the nice cool shade." After a while, when the suffering of cool has become a little bigger than the suffering of heat, you say, "Well, Ty, let's go sit in the nice warm sun." You sit in the sun and the suffering of cold goes down, the suffering of heat goes up. While still what is the bigger suffering is going down, at that point we recognize it as pleasure. It's not real pleasure. It's just the exchange of one contaminated suffering for another. Having that insight, those of you who study the classics, as we say, as Ben says, the 400 stanzas of yogic activity by Aryadeva, the second chapter in that talks is Holiness mentions is the sort of the source in the Mahayana for this deep explanation of changeable suffering. that what we call happiness is actually the nature of suffering. Aryadeva was the principal disciple of Nagarjuna. And this very famous text he wrote called the 400 stanzas, sometimes just called the 400, abbreviated even more, 400 stanzas of the yogic activities of bodhisattvas. There, the second chapter talks much about this, because this kind of insight can help you to develop renunciation. We can understand, we can renounce obvious suffering, but we still want our stracciatella. We still want our Richard Gere. So if you imagine embracing Richard Gere, I mentioned this in the other course. In the other course, I told you that in Japan, I remember when I said this, I said, okay, imagine this, and I heard in the back, so imagine Richard, imagine embracing Richard Gere, or I don't know, who would the men like to, some men might like to embrace Richard Gere also, but anyway, but, you know, some woman, if you're a man. But embrace, you know, at first is incredibly satisfying and pleasurable. But after an hour, 2 hours, 6 hours, you know, body odor. I'm sure you've experienced, you know, your arm gets tired. And if embracing Richard Gere were really pleasurable, you should be, you should remain there. You would never have to separate. Meditate in this way. In all of the different way, all of the different things that might entrance you for future lives in cyclic existence. Even if I had them, I wouldn't really be happy. This incredibly powerful understanding to develop this state of mind of renunciation. One part is recognizing nothing within cyclic existence as worthy of your trust. There's nothing, sort of like the stance of a lion before whom you've placed a big bale of hay. You know, not a big bowl of meat, red meat, but just, you know, can imagine the lion. Put the bale of hay. No interest whatsoever, right? Catherine's not here tonight, is he?
No.
Yeah. I wanted to tell them a story about when I was here the last time. Some of you know Catherine DeVerter's husband, Massimo. He's really a fan of comic books, classic comic books. Before I'd come here, I'd called up India. I was teaching Lama Oso, the reincarnation of Lama Yeshe at the time, little Spanish boy. And I asked Lama if there was anything he wanted. And he said, yeah, bring back some comics. And I said, oh, okay, I'll try. When I came down here, I talked to Massimo, and he took me to a comic store. We got some whole pile of classics. You know, he gave me some of his extra classics. You know, I had this big pile. I went back to India. I was in Bangalore. I called Lama on the phone. I said, Lama, I'm coming. I'll be there tomorrow. I've got about 50 comics for you. And he's like, yeah. I get to the monastery, and I bring this pile of, this is almost like the lion and the hay. I put this pile of comics before him, and Lama goes, what's that? I said, some comics. I had forgotten that our code word for videos was comics, because he wasn't supposed to watch videos. And if I were to go into Mysore, he would say, I said, you know, Lama, do you need anything? He said, yeah, get me a comic, because he didn't want his dad to hear it. And he said, I said, comics. So this is like the bale of hay before the lion, you know. You know, it's just, you know, I wanted DVD. Anything within cyclic existence that might entrance you, that would take you off of the path, to try to recognize that it doesn't bring ultimate happiness. That's one part of renunciation.